A couple of days ago, I had a moment of fear, one of many during the retreat, of course. And that led to several thoughts or insights. One was I was reflecting on the themes that have arisen in our discussions together, and reflected that so many of the issues that have been raised and that we're working with really have their root in fear. And I thought, I've never seen a systematic explanation of how to work with fear. Somebody should really do that. And then I realized, I think I'm still somebody. So what I'd like to lay out is a map of possible ways of working with fear. And I have to say, I'm very surprised as I reflected on this. I was really surprised. I actually haven't seen a systematic treatment of how to work with it, not just in Buddhism, but in a variety, in any of the great traditions, which is surprising because, and it's not even, fear is not even one of the mental elements in the Buddhist psychology, the Abhidhamma, for a reason which is I've never understood. But it's certainly part of being human. It goes with being identified with a separate self sense. One could almost say, one could say that the separate self sense is rooted in a sense of deficiency and fear. And as we know, of all the emotions, it can be the most difficult to be with and work with. In the Christian tradition, there's a saying that hell is fear. And in the times of the Inquisition, they would talk about 3 degrees of torture. The 3rd degree of torture was actually inflicting it. But the first was just telling a person about what would happen to them. And the 2nd degree was actually showing them the instruments of torture and then leaving them for a couple of days. And this was, that alone was horrific enough, just the fear is hellish and horrific enough to force a quotes confession out of most people. So fear can be a torture, which raises 2 very obvious questions. One is, does it have to be torturous? And the second is, are there ways to reduce it? So I consider myself somewhat of an expert on fear, having experienced enormous amounts of it, and having tried mightily and unsuccessfully to get rid of it. This goes back quite a ways. In my childhood, I was, to put it mildly, athletically challenged. I was nicknamed Feb, short for feeble. But in my teens, I finally found some sports I could do and loved, and those were kind of acrobatic type things. So I dived very deeply into trampolining. I have 2 major claims to fame in my life. One is that I had a brief career, which is the highlight of my curriculum vitae in university life. Much of life is for building your curriculum vitae. But the highlight of mine is one of my career positions, which was circus acrobat. And the other claim to fame is that at one time in my misguided youth, I held the world record for high diving. And living. In order to get the record, you have to survive. It's not enough to hurl yourself off something very high. You actually have to survive it. And I'd been into competitive diving and high diving and so forth. And I figured out, I've dived from this high. It shouldn't be all that much to dive from that high. So there was a bridge, a locally, which was very high, something like 120 feet. And so I figured out this was quite doable, and I arranged for some friends with a boat below and some a camera and to film it. And then I, while they were below, I climbed the bridge and stepped out there and looked down and immediately knew I'd made a very bad mistake. I was freaked. But there, way below this little dot, was this guys with cameras filming. And I could either go down in posterity as setting this world record, or I could be filmed climbing down the bridge. So I jumped or dived and survived with only, with only minor injuries. So it was a useful experience. And as a result of doing all these acrobatics, I found there was a kind of almost a pleasure in being counterphobic and kind of pushing yourself up against the edge. And a number of you here have done, you know, if you're here, you're used to pushing yourself up against edges. So you've done it a lot, and some of you have done it in sports of various kinds. And you know that there can kind of be a kind of adrenaline rush that can be, which you can ride either on the fear or the kind of the high of that. And it's very interesting. In experiments, they've done experiments where they give people adrenaline, and they tell one group that this is you're about to get a chemical which may make you feel a little anxious and so forth and scared possibly. On the other, you'll probably feel excited with this. And the autonomic reaction is pretty much the same, and people have the experience they anticipate. So, you know that, you know, it is possible to work with, to be up against fear and to experience as a kind of rush, as long as it's not overwhelming, of course. So I figured I had a bit of experience in working with fear. But then, as part of my psychiatry training, I went into therapy. And shortly after, I began to practice meditation. And I was blown away at how much fear I had. That there seemed to be just layers and layers of fear. And I was astounded how much fear was in the mind. I remember in my first three-month retreat having a conversation with Jack Kornfield about this, and he said, do you think Freud even had any idea how much fear there is in the mind? So there was this discovery of an enormous amount of fear. And unfortunately, I concocted a story out of that which was rather painful and unnecessary and producing of suffering. And that was, I concluded, I must be an exceptionally fearful person. And that's a risk which all of us who do deep introspective work and come up against our fears and our neuroses and our phobias and so forth run, of concluding, oh, there's something wrong with me, instead of appreciating this is the human existential condition. This is the way the darkened mind is. Well, but fortunately, initially in psychotherapy and then in meditation, I discovered that simply facing fear, simply being willing to be with it and simply open to it and experiencing it, tended to allow it to dissolve. And so here I made another bad mistake. I took on as my mission that I was going to get rid of fear. Bad mistake. So I became hypervigilant in my meditation and during my daily activities, looking for fear, being aware of it, so I could work with it. And so I would be in some situation, some emotional, little emotional twinge would arise, and I'd go, is that fear? It'd be this internal alerting response, which was itself fear. So unfortunately, what I didn't know, but what I had to learn the hard way, was that the attachment to getting rid of fear reinforces the aversion to it. Okay? If you're attached to getting rid of fear, you just fuel the aversion to it. Okay? And that's part of a more general and very important principle about the way the mind works, and particularly about behavior and its the beliefs which motivate behavior. Any behavior tends to reinforce or strengthen the belief which it comes out of. So my belief, fear is bad and I have to get rid of it, my working to get rid of it reinforced that belief, my belief that fear is bad and painful and to be gotten rid of. Okay, so our actions reinforce the beliefs that motivate them in this case. The second was that the second of three problems that came out of this was that I would get all these false alarms. As I said, I'd be sitting there and some emotion would arise and go, is that fear? So there would be these false alarms and a reactions. Fear reactions to a whole slew of experiences. The false alarms created more fear. And here's where it gets really interesting. It also perpetuated, this attempt to get rid of fear also perpetuated it in a very interesting way. If you're attached to getting rid of fear, what does the mind have to keep creating so it can keep getting rid of it? Interesting. And the mind will create whatever it thinks it needs. The mind creates the experiences it thinks it needs. And if you think you need to get rid of fear and you got to be working on it, it will create fear and keep you occupied for a long time. What one resists persists. Okay, so those were my unskillful attempts to work with fear. Are there some more skillful ones? Fortunately, there are. In fact, we have 2,500 years of people offering us ways of working with it. And in our tradition, and of course in other traditions too, and in contemporary psychology and psychotherapy. Now, in our tradition of Dzogchen, it's really very simple. When fear arises, we simply relax with awareness. You know, the response to most every experience in this practice is relaxation. And it's particularly valuable with fear. And we follow Nyosho Kempo's four pith instructions. When anything arises, but specifically now fear, when fear arises, we don't try to change it. However, if spontaneously the mind comes up with its attempts to shift, change, and work with and do things to the fear, fine. We don't try to change those. Okay? So we accept not only the fear, but also the reactions to it. So first, of Nosho Kenpo's four-fifth instructions, we don't try to change the fear. Second, we don't construct a story around it. You know, my story, I'm a fearful person, was not particularly helpful. And then there's no end of possible stories we tell ourselves. Third, we don't even try to improve ourselves or to cultivate anything, or in this case, we don't even try to cultivate fearlessness. It's okay to be fearful. And to whatever extent we can, we don't become distracted. Now, when we do this, then you notice the fear transmutes into raw energy. It just becomes like a little burst of energy, and energy and clarity. So it self-liberates, transmutes and self-liberates. And in this perspective, fear is not a problem. However, now if we can do that, wonderful. If we can simply be with, rest in awareness while fear arises, nothing else need be done. However, if fear is overwhelming, either on the cushion or in life, then it's fine to work with it interventionally. And there's a spectrum of interventions or ways of working with fear. We can map them in several ways. I'm going to map them onto the four yanas here, the Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and the Dzogchen. But one can also map them in terms of how interventional they are, how active, or how, on the other hand, how subtle they are. And the general principle is it's useful to use the most subtle intervention that you can. And the most subtle, of course, is no intervention, i.e. Dzogchen, Drekchen. Okay? So I want to run through a slew of possibilities here. And first I want to start off the cushion with simple behavioral strategies for working with fear. And the first is simply to put it into words, to communicate. Either by talking with someone, which is a time-honored method, and some of us make a living out of this, listening to this, or by journaling. Just putting fears or any difficult emotional experience into words is very powerful. And particularly if we communicate it, but just putting into words shifts it from subject to object. That is, when we feel fearful, we are identified with the fear. Putting it into words objectifies it, separates us from it, disidentifies us from it, and then we can look at it with much less reactivity. So, first behavioral strategy, just put it into words. Find someone to talk to. It's very, very helpful, as I'm sure we all know. Second is relaxation training. It's just a very useful skill to have. And there are some techniques in addition to our meditative techniques that work with the body, for example, doing systematic muscle relaxation, learning how to tense and relax the muscles because of the intimate psychosomatic link. When the body is relaxed, as you know, it's very hard for the mind to be tense and contracted and fearful. So, and that's one of the principles of our practice. We sit in a way with the spine erect and the rest of the body as relaxed as we possibly can. And it's that combination of erect spine and relaxed body which fosters the mental state of a relaxed alertness that is optimal for our recognition of awareness. Third strategy, and it's hard to overemphasize this, is acceptance. Easier said than done, but extremely important. So much of suffering comes from the unwillingness to have pain or have difficult experiences. And it's not to say that difficult experiences aren't difficult, but it is to say that there's a formula in psychology or in some areas that suffering equals pain times resistance. The more we resist an experience, the more suffering it produces. So a quick way into this is to ask some questions of yourself. And here you have to be really honest with yourself. And the first question is, am I willing to let it be okay to have this fear? And then just to feel intuitively for the response. And sometimes we'll find, out of our wisdom and understanding of what's skillful, we'll find that, okay, I'm willing. Another way to, if that's a bit challenging, another way to do it in a little more gradated way is to ask yourself, okay, am I willing to let it be okay to have this fear for the next 10 minutes or the next half hour or whatever it is? Put a time frame on it. If yes, I am willing to bet. Try this as an experiment. If you do that and you get a yes, I'm willing to bet that you'll find the fear collapses and becomes significantly reduced. Okay? Because it's our resistance which fuels it. Okay? Now, that's fine if we get that answer. If we get the answer, no, I'm not willing, then here's where it gets doubly interesting. Now our challenge is to accept our unwillingness to accept. Really? It's true. Okay? So then the question is, am I willing to let it be okay that I can't accept this fear? At some stage, you'll probably find a yes. And it can be, at times, you know, you can go out another step. I've had to go out another step. Sometimes there'll be fear, and there's fear of the fear, and then there's getting angry that here I am being fearful again. It's like, okay, am I willing to let it be okay that I'm angry, that I'm fearful of my fear? Really? It works. Because as long as we're resistant to the complex as a whole will stick there. Okay? And then the fourth strategy, once you've learned some of these skills, and all of us here certainly have learned a lot of skills, but this is not something you suggest to someone right off, but for a community like this, at a certain stage it can be very useful and skillful to be counterphobic. And that is to deliberately put yourself in situations which elicit fear. And there are Vajrayana practices which do that very, very skillfully. So, first approach, the behavioral approach, working off the cushion. First, communicate, put it into words. Second, relaxation. Third, acceptance. And finally, being counterphobic, deliberately putting yourself into the situations you fear. Okay. Then there are meditative approaches. So let's start with the Theravadin approaches. And the central practice of Theravadin Buddhism is Vipassana, or central meditative practice. And Vipassana is a wonderful practice because it teaches us to really be with and investigate experience. And that is a very skillful strategy for any painful emotional state. So with fear or any difficult emotion, what one does is one directs attention to the emotion, to the fear, and stays with it as continuously as you can. And you investigate it. What is it actually like to feel fear? I'm willing to bet when you investigate it, you'll find that it has a complex of experiences, that it has, yes, it has an emotional tone, but beyond that, it has a somatic sensation. It has a somatic location in the body. It has imagery that comes up with it and accompanies it. It has thoughts that will often give you very valuable insights into it and its cause and what it's about. And if you can, if you have the concentration, it's really valuable to see if you can put your attention or your awareness right into the middle, into the center of that fear. Now this practice, this Vipassana, this in being with, bringing mindfulness to investigating fear and any other difficult emotion, does several things. Firstly, it reduces the aversion. You are doing something counter-aversive. Instead, usually when fear arises, the mind contracts and wants to pull away and not look closely. And that just reinforces the aversion. What this does is it's counterphobic. It goes, instead of withdrawing, it goes towards the fear. And that is a very profound practice. One of the most dramatic examples I know of came from Michael Hana, who is the world's authority on shamanism. And Michael Hana is an anthropologist who, in his early anthropological days, went down to South America to live with the Eshwa Indians. And he heard about this practice of shamanism and dutifully took notes. And he heard about this practice of taking ayahuasca and dutifully took notes and thought, well, that's very interesting, so forth. I think it got kind of interesting in the shamanic practices. And the shaman said to him, you know, if you really want to understand this, you really need to take some ayahuasca. He thought, well, okay, take a little, you know, this vine extract. Okay, fine. No big deal. Uh-huh. And he was given a specific instruction. And that was, he was given a stick, and he said, if anything fearful arises during your experience on the ayahuasca, you must run towards the fearful thing and touch it with a stick. So there's this wonderfully counterphobic instruction. And sure enough, he had this mind-opening, mind-boggling ayahuasca trip. It's a very powerful psychedelic. And his understanding of shamanism was totally changed forever. And he had some very, in the midst of it, he was given this ayahuasca and left alone in the Amazon jungle with his stick. And sure enough, fearful experiences did arise, surprise, surprise. And he ran towards this fearful apparition. And as he touched it, it disappeared. It's like an exquisite instruction in counterphobic working with fear. Okay. So, as the saying goes, face what you fear and fear will disappear. So, in Theravadin practice, vipassana, awareness, investigation, exploration of fear. Second practice, antidotes. We can cultivate an antidote. That is a mind state or mental element which is oppositional to fear. And I've mentioned one, relaxation, or in the tradition, calm, or equanimity. Or another classic antidote is love, metta, loving kindness. And there's a story in the Pali Sutras of a group of monks who went into the forest to meditate, which was a pretty impressive thing to do in those times. I mean, there were tigers and, you know, they believed in spirits and ghosts, and I mean, you know, it was a pretty gutsy thing just to take yourself off by yourself into the midst of the forest. After a while, they came running back, complaining of a lot of fear. And the Buddha said he would give them an armor which would protect them against all fear. And what did he do? He taught them metta, taught them practice of loving kindness. So loving kindness is an antidote to fear. Fear, calm, equanimity are what are called reciprocally inhibiting of fear. That is, these mental qualities inhibit the arising and the persisting of fear. Okay? In the Christian tradition, there's a saying, perfect love casts out fear. And this is a central teaching of classic Buddhism. Okay, so that's classic Buddhism, Theravadin. What about Mahayana practices? Well, the central recognition of the Mahayana is the recognition, the insight of shunyata. The evolution of Buddhism from Theravadin to Mahayana went from a recognition of anatta, that is, the insubstantiality of the self, to shunyata, the recognition of the insubstantiality of all phenomena. And shunyata is a tricky one. I remember asking Lama Surya in one of my early retreats with him many years ago about shunyata. He sighed and said, shunyata is a tough nut to crack. But the core is that the more deeply we look into any phenomena or any experience, the less we find an essence to it. That is, when we look closely at a car, the more closely we look, the more we see a steering wheel and a windshield and a window wiper and a seat. And we see the components, the elements. And if we look at those elements, they too, we see that they are composed of myriad sub-elements. So what we take to be car is actually a concept laid on top of this complex experience. Now, this sounds all very abstract and theoretical and interesting, but it has some very, very important practical implications. The more, because, and here's an experiment we can all do, and this is a very nice way to get some initial insights into shunyata. The more closely we look at fear or any other emotion, the more you find that the experience of fear disappears, and what you find are raw sensations and movement. And in place of a sense of fear, one experiences raw sensation, and you literally see through the fear. And the more closely you see it, the less aversive and fearful it is. In fact, the more deeply you look at any emotion, the less of any emotional quality it has. Okay? We only experience fear when we have a certain distance from the experience, the actual experience. So what we actually are reacting to is the concept. Shunyata's central implication is that we react not to things or experiences themselves, but to the concepts we create of them. And that is crucially important. Because usually we experience the concepts and not the actual experience. Okay, so Theravadin, Mahayana, with the central insight of Mahayana being shunyata, and the very practical implications this has for working with difficult emotions. Then Vajrayana. Some of the Vajrayana practices work very specifically with fear. And they use, in particular, as far as I can see, well, they use an awful lot of things. As you know, who've done these visualization deity practices, they are just multi-layered and multi-dimensional. They work in so many ways. I don't even pretend to understand all the ways they work. But two of the key processes by which the practices that specifically work with fear have their effects are first by being counterphobic, and secondly by using the fear for compassion. And the two main practices here that we'll be familiar with are chud and Vajrakalaya. And chud is this very interesting practice of visualizing oneself, offering one's body and having it boiled and dissolved, and then offering it as an offering to all the demons, which is pretty counterphobic. But what's what is really key is it is a practice of compassion. It is a transmutation. It is a doing of what one most fears, an offering of what is most valuable, one's body, in order to foster the well-being, relieve the suffering, and bring to enlightenment the beings who most desperately need it. So it is doing a counterphobic practice, but motivated by compassion. And compassion is also an exquisite antidote to fear. And some of us here have done the Vajrakalaya practice, the practice in which you visualize yourself as this fearful, fearsome-looking deity figure in the most obnoxious situation you can possibly visualize, charnel grounds and a palace of skulls and bones and so forth. And you visualize yourself with this consort, this three-eyed, fanged, taloned, blood-dripping, skull-wearing and not wearing anything other female consort, not the usual kind of woman I usually spend 8 hours a day visualizing having sex with, but powerful. It's a great, it's designed to bring up one's stuff and to work with it in the context and with the purpose of compassion, of developing fearlessness and power in order to be of most effective service and to cultivate upaya, skillful means. So, practices in life, Theravadan contemplative practices, Mahayana practices, Vajrayana practices. A key element here, a core thing, is that, and a wonderful recontextualization of fear, is the recognition, which is at the heart of the Vajrayana practices, that we can transform our fear into a gift. First, recall that facing one's fear is a gift to everyone. There's a phenomenon called emotional contagion, which basically means consciousness is catching. We pick up one another's emotions. We all know this. What we didn't know until actually this last decade, when the social scientists developed some new research techniques for investigating the way in which emotions and behaviors flow through social networks. What we didn't know is just how far our emotions and behaviors can spread through social networks. And quite literally, and this is solid research, if, for example, you take up a practice and you cultivate loving kindness and you gradually reduce your fear, that emotional shift, that reduction in fear, will be transmitted to your family and friends, and to their family and friends, and to the friends of their friends. That is, these emotional shifts that we cultivate can actually be traced out through an extensive social network, so that our emotional changes change the emotions in people we may never have met. So palpably that we can actually be measured in research studies. Okay, it works both ways. Someone becomes depressed, the friends of their friend of a friend may become depressed, more depressed. Someone becomes very happy, that family, their family, their friend of the family, the friend of the friends of the family tend to become happier. Okay, so our working with fear is a gift to everyone. First, because it reduces emotional contagion. But second, because it reduces our reactivity to fear in other people. It enables us to be with other people's fear and aversion and the reactivity with less reactivity ourselves. And that gives us interpersonal power, the capacity to be with and not be thrown off center, to be more effective, to be more helpful. So, the first way in which we transform our fear into a gift is simply by working with it, reducing it, becoming less, spreading it less, becoming less reactive. The second is that we can use our fear to remember that this is how all people feel. This is part of the human condition. Other people are feeling the fear we fear, and probably a lot more. And when we recognize that, we can begin to see that when anyone is defensive or aggressive or obnoxious, it has its roots in their fear. And to the extent we can recognize that, compassion arises spontaneously. Our non-reactivity allows us to see the fear that underlies other people's reactivity. And out of that is birthed compassion. And to the extent we're able to respond to their fear with less reactivity, to that extent, we're able to respond with compassion and with greater skillfulness. So our work with fear becomes our gift, not only to ourselves, but to everyone we interact with. So, would anyone like to comment or question?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for offering this teaching. The question that comes to mind is you brought up in the Mahayana the central concept that we're dealing with is shunyata, something that essentially is the antithesis of labeling. And the first step in the process that you outlined is, of course, giving it words, giving it name and form. So perhaps you could speak toward how your teaching model reconciles this first step, giving it name and form, with the integration and seeing it through the lens of shunyata, which is labelless.
I think it's useful to keep in mind that strategies or practices are stage appropriate. That is, different practices are appropriate for different stages. And so if one can see into fear and recognize its emptiness, then there won't be the need to do much with it. But that's not where I live all the time. And so it's very useful for me to be able to talk with people about it. Does that handle it?
Yeah, sure.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed that presentation. One question I have for you is, isn't there some fundamental usefulness to fear in helping us, you know, to identify danger?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. So part of wisdom is seeing seeing when fear is useful and when it's simply less skillful. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, all these human emotions have their value, but they also again have a stage specific value. That is, it's very useful for as a child for us to be scareful, be fearful of looking over a cliff. As an adult, we probably don't need as much fear as we have. But the conditioned fear responses often stay. So, the reality is that there's an awful lot of fear that just isn't necessary. But pay attention to when it, use it when we need it. Yeah, absolutely.
Roger, I just wanted to add something to the last thing you were saying about the consciousness being infectious. For all those that want to do this, there's something on YouTube. There's a doctor talking about mirror neurons. So there's, I think, something right there for people to look at.
Good, thank you. Oh yeah, speaking of websites, that reminds me, if you want instructions for this systematic relaxation training program, they're on my website, drrogerwalsh.com.
Also, to the same thing that Bill was just talking about, in the most recent issue of the Parabola Journal, maybe you've seen it, is an article about a woman who, by a woman who trains horses, and she had a horse who was so neurologically damaged and traumatized that it was so reactive, and it would have been put down if she hadn't worked with this horse. And what she found and what she talks about is how her calmness and her equanimity, she must be Buddhist, although she doesn't say, but
closet Buddhist.
Yeah, she's a bodhisattva anyway. But her non-reactivity and her willingness to stand and just be with this horse became contagious. So it was cross species as well as from person to person. It's like the social network thing. Mm-hmm. And this horse became so bonded to her where before it was attacking her. Mm. It's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for outlining all of this. years ago, I was studying with a Zen master, and I did a very intensive training for a number of years, and much to my surprise, I found out that I was afraid of everything. And the first year I was studying, sitting hours every day, I looked at my life and I saw that it had been directed by fear. I had avoided many things because I was afraid, thinking I was choosing to go in directions that simply were the safest way to go. And my teacher during that period kept saying, face it, face it. And revel in it. I mean, you're afraid, okay, be afraid, be afraid. Don't change it, just let it be. And I saw I was afraid of eating the wrong, anyway, it just was endless. And then I began to realize I didn't know where it was coming from, that it was a buzz, that it was not the stepping out in front of a truck, useful fear, that it was like a big bang buzz left over from something. What was it? What was it? What was it? And I sat with that, and I began to notice that I had every day, in the morning sit, a memory of my father dying when I was 4, that he came through the living room and walked into a wall and fell down. He was trying to get through an opening in a door and screaming. And that he died right after that, and then, and I, so I would silently weep every morning and relive this. As I was sitting in the Zendo, I was sitting in the chair in the living room, and the two, myself at that point in the Zendo, and the child, the four-year-old child, watching this happen, were coming closer and closer to being the same. And so I was encouraged to just let that play through. And what happened was, as I saw that this was the buzz, the fear, that everything past that point, after his death, was a life in a family of fear. My mother was afraid and very angry, and everything had changed, and no one talked about it. And so decisions within the family were made fear-based. So I began to really deeply appreciate that and appreciate with love my mother, my father, the little child, and just simply allowing this experience, not trying to create any kind of experience sitting, but just allowing whatever was coming up to come up. The experience continued to come up, this little child and myself. And then one morning, I was sitting in the Zendo, and it began again with the little child and me. And the entire sitting period, my dad, in this memory, never walked into the room. He never missed the doorway. He never fell. And the child and the woman merged. And there was a deep body memory through this meditation, the shunyata, of what it was like before that trauma. And the fear, this buzzing fear, like a hula hoop that I was sustaining and not even knowing why, just dropped. And it never has come back in that way.
Beautiful. Yeah.
So meditation itself, as I'm sure you know, accesses that more ancient part of the brain, and when this spinning, this newer organic structure is allowed to process and settle.
Yeah, and there's an important point in what you you said briefly that I want to bring out, and that is usually we have, you know, just a background flavor of fear that's always there. Well, sorry, not always there, but it's just latent there, whatever its origins. And one of the things that's really important to know about is that fear will latch on to an object or a reason. That is, fear doesn't, kind of this background fear is constantly looking for things to be afraid of. Okay? And so there'll be this background fear, and then it'll latch on to something, and we think, oh, I'm scared of that, when actually it may be just, as you were saying, a more background reservoir that is there, and which as we sit, will gradually release and become less of an issue. So, yeah. Okay, well, let's take a moment to be grateful for the opportunity of being together, to reflect for a moment on the practice, the recognition of the free and well-favored life, that our lives are free of all the afflictions and difficulties and challenges which create so much suffering for so many people, which would prevent us from being able to practice. And we are favored with all the requisites that have to come together in order to be able to be together and practice Dharma in such a wonderful situation and setting. So let's feel gratitude for a moment. Appreciate our extraordinary good fortune. And may we recognize that actually our deepest desire is to use our good fortune in our lives and all that we experience and explore together here for the welfare and awakening of all.